And welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about energy policy here in the United States. Last week, the House passed an energy bill that proved controversial, as would be expected. Supporters say that this bill will boost domestic energy production. Opponents argued the bill was loaded with tax breaks for the oil and gas companies, and they said that it will do very little to bring down the cost of energy. President Bush, for the past couple of days, has been talking about the need to move ahead on energy policy. He basically endorsed those things that were in the House package, talked about some others, and urged the Senate to get to work and see if sometime, perhaps later this summer, there could be a bill coming out of the Senate, and then the two would have to get reconciled, and we'd go on from there. Our guest for the program in this hour is James McKenzie. He is a senior associate in the World Resources Institute's program in climate, energy, and pollution. The World Resources Institute is an independent nonprofit organization. It was launched in 1982, interested in promoting discussion of, awareness of, environmental issues. His particular interests, that is Dr. McKenzie's, include transportation, climate change, and energy security. He is a professional lecturer in the School of Advanced International Studies of the Johns Hopkins University. He's also a visiting fellow in the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation program. Before he went to work at the World Resources Institute, he was a senior staff scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And before that, from 1977 until 1981, he was a senior staff member for energy at the President's Council on Environmental Quality, and that president was Jimmy Carter. He has a PhD in physics from the University of Minnesota and did postgrad work at Los Alamos and Argonne National Laboratories. And we're pleased that he could be with us this morning to talk. Questions, as always, are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-WILL or 9455. That's probably easier to remember it that way. We do also have the toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call. Dr. McKenzie, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. I'm not quite sure where to start, but maybe it is the place to start is by talking about oil and its price, and also the kinds of things that seem to be up for discussion now in Washington to deal with issue of supply and price.
Right.
Right at now, I believe that the price of a barrel of oil is $51.61, I think. The price is one thing we know, that it's been over $50 a barrel for more than 2 months now, and that set a high, over $57. And so it's a serious issue, and the people are feeling it, certainly in the price of gasoline, which seems to add greater urgency and emphasis to the need for policy and to see what, in fact, we can do to increase the supply, lessen our dependence on imports, and ultimately do something about price. What do you think about the proposal that's now come through the House, and whether in fact it will address the issue of supply as far as oil is concerned, and ultimately price for the things that we use that are made out of oil, like gasoline?
Good question. The bill is kind of a hodgepodge, and it is weighted toward expansion of supply from the oil and the gas industry, a proposal for refineries and military bases, things of that sort. The problem is that it does not address the problem, which is something that's neglected. There's an old saying in medicine that if you don't know what the problem is, you can't solve it. And this is the case here, where we have a series of linked problems which on the surface appear to be independent, but which in fact are quite closely linked. And they're all related to the fossil fuels that we burn in our cars and homes. 85% of U.S. energy supply is accounted for by oil, coal, and natural gas. And these are the principal problems that we really have to consider and compare with when we go ahead and look at the proposals that are being made. For example, greenhouse gases account for 85% of our energy supply. This is the oil, coal, and the gas that I referred to, and 85% of global emissions. So they're a major element in global warming, and it's something we have to worry about when we go ahead and propose measures to deal with it. Fossil fuels are also a threat to national security because they are heavily weighted upon by oil. And oil is in short supply in this country and going to be short supply worldwide. In 1970, U.S. crude oil production peaked in 1970, and it has been declining ever since. And we are now importing, to make up that difference, about 50% of our oil. And it's something we don't appreciate until you see the body bags coming back from Iraq. Mm. And 66% of the oil that's remaining in the ground is in the Persian Gulf. And that's going to be reaching a peak as well, probably within 10 to 15 years. So we have oil as a major source of global climate change, a major element in our security risks. And then lastly, they're an air pollution problem as well. So they do pose these many problems. And if you take a rational approach to it, you start trying to focus on those measures which will deal with all of those problems together instead of one by one or not at all. Mm-hmm. We need a vision of the future so that this is like building a house. You don't build a house without plans. Well, why should you build an energy program without some sense of what the problem is or what the energy is? And indeed, I just give you a couple of elements of what I think ought to be in a rational energy program. We should be increasing the tax subsidies for high-efficiency appliances and other energy devices. Efficiency is still the cheapest source, but there are institutional barriers against our using energy more efficiently, and we have to overcome those barriers. We have to start moving away from the fossil fuels, oil, coal, and natural gas, and move to renewables, such as photovoltaic cells and wind turbines and things of that sort. And if nuclear can be made safe, that would be an element, too, since that deals most of those problems. But at the moment, it is not, I think, publicly acceptable. And the notion of being able to subsidize it, as the administration has proposed, to overcome the public concern, I think, is misguided. There are good reasons why people are concerned about nuclear safety and waste disposal, and they have to be addressed directly if he's going to increase the use of nuclear. Coal and nuclear both have serious problems. Coal would have to be produces CO2 and carbon dioxide is made a greenhouse gas, and it has to be sequestered, the CO2, underground if you're going to use coal in large amounts. And, of course, nuclear has waste disposal and safety, which is not going to be overcome by insurance premiums. In fact, the industry the reason we have an industry is because of the Price-Anderson Act, which provided insurance for utilities so that they wouldn't have to worry about serious accidents. And we need to get more efficient vehicles. I drive a Prius, a Toyota Prius, and we're getting 53 miles per gallon. It's a very comfortable car, four doors, and it's an example of the kind of technology which can be brought to bear on the problem. And lastly, we need to reduce energy demand through subsidies and through taxes. For example, we could increase energy taxes and use that money to fund the Social Security Fund. We can subsidize consumers by reducing sales taxes on very high-efficient cars and things of that sort. So there is a pattern to the problem and there's a pattern to the solutions. And I think we would do wise if we were to spend a little more time thinking about what it is we're trying to do rather than just trying to get it done and getting into a political football game, trying to pass your favorite measure. Mm.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, and then we'll get back to some of these issues, perhaps explore them in a little bit more depth. We're talking with Dr. Jim McKenzie. He is a senior associate in World Resources in the World Resources Institute program in climate, energy, and pollution, and has done work, written books, and studies in a number of areas, including transportation, climate change, energy security. He is a PhD doctor. He has a physics degree from University of Minnesota. Also has worked for the Union of Concerned Scientists and was for a number of years a senior staff member for energy at the President's Council on Environmental Quality, and that was Jimmy Carter, that president. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to return to the issue of world oil production. I know this is something where, depending upon who you ask, you might get a different answer. There are some people who think that we may actually be at, possibly even have passed the peak. Other people say, well, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. The Department of Energy says we won't hit the peak till 2037. But the important issue is here that people say, well, no matter when the peak comes, you'd better start getting ready to deal with that. And it could take you as much as a decade or two before you could really be geared up to deal with the problem of declining production. And, of course, it's, for those people who argue we're at the peak, it's too late. What do you think now is a reasonable sort of figure? You're saying you think actually within the next few years you think that probably we'll get at the – we'll be at the peak of world oil production?
Yes. Let me comment on that. First, consider the U.S. model because it is a very striking example of the kind of simple analysis that can be done to look at this problem. M. King Hubbard, who is a great geophysicist, in 1956, he asked all his colleagues how much oil they thought would be pumped from the lower 48 states, and it ranged from 150 to 200 billion barrels. So that's a big difference. And he used those estimates to predict when it would peak, if that's where that were the case. And he got 1965 to 1970, and his best guess was 1970. So he hit the money right. He hit the nail on the head. Mm-hmm. Now, global is somewhat more difficult because the data are proprietary. They belong to certain countries, and it's hard to predict, or it's hard to get the full number. So the analysis that I did on this particular problem was to look at potential sources in the range that people thought would be ultimately recoverable. And we're talking about crude oil now, conventional crude oil, not talking about tar sands or bitumen, which is a very heavy, thick, viscous oil, but basically what is now used for the basis for the oil industry. And I found that if you take this range and you apply it to what we've already produced, that it would be someplace between 2010 and 2020, peaking would occur. Now, for all intents and purposes, that's one that doesn't make any difference. 2010 and 2020 is the same number, really, because it takes a long time to introduce new energy sources. Typically, in this country, if you look historically, the introduction of oil, coal, gas, and nuclear, it grows at 6% per year, and it takes maybe 50 to 60 years to make a major dent on the problem with new sources. So I think that the message that we're hearing, and we're hearing it more and more from the oil industry, confidentially if not outwardly, that production globally will probably peak in 2010, 2020. And then we're really going to be in trouble because there isn't that much. There's no place where we can import it from. We imported it to the U.S., but we can't do that globally, obviously. So I think that there is a growing consensus that is what we have to face. And we, given the global change problem and security problem, it's time that we start moving away from the fossil fuels, despite their convenience and apparent temporary abundance. It is going to be a different game within our lifetimes.
I know that there are people who argue that, well, it's possible that we have gotten all the oil that's easy to get. There is also oil that's available. It's out there. It's in the world, but maybe in places and in forms and under conditions that make it difficult and in the past have made it not economically feasible. But at the kind of prices that we're talking about now, and if the prices continue to go up, then actually that does mean that it would be economically feasible to go after some of these oil and some of these other places. Does that do, assuming that that is true, does that really do anything for us in increasing the supply?
It is true that higher prices will bring forth more drilling. And if you look again at the U.S. history, during the 80s, the 70s and the 80s, it was prices of fuel were high. There was a quadrupling of drilling for oil. And yet the record shows that the production of new oil just continued to decline. And despite the fact that the prices were higher, it is a geological problem, and it is not easily solved just by raising oil prices somewhat. I think that you have to be careful about what it is we're talking about and what in the record on what has happened elsewhere. It's not so readily done. You can look also globally that many sources are beginning to decline. The North Sea, United Kingdom, has hit a peak and is beginning to decline, and the exploration companies are now in very deep water, and they wouldn't be there if they had oil that is readily available. So I think that the record shows that the scarcity is growing and is beginning to show its impact, and that higher prices, though helpful, will not solve the problem in toto or readily in any short-term period.
All right. Let's talk with a caller here, someone in Urbana, and line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how familiar are you with the with what they're planning on trying to do up at Anwar?
Okay.
I guess I'm wondering, I mean, are they, would the oil companies be offering the federal government, a federal lease, like a 1/6 royalty type of arrangement? Where they oil companies would get 5/6 and give the Treasury 1/6.
Okay,
situation.
I can't comment on the nature of the leasing agreements, but I can tell you this: that I did an analysis of Anwar and assumed the oil up there would be in the range that the U.S. Geological Survey estimated, with a mean value of 10 billion barrels. And then it's a straightforward matter to assume that, say, that oil would be found and drilled and pipelines would be built and all this. It would probably take 10 years, and then it would produce oil probably for 15 to 20 years and then start declining. And it turns out that the entire amount is really very small compared with anything like the demand. U.S. production is declining, and this oil would probably become available in 2025, 2030. And I don't know how to make the trade-off between the value of the caribou and the wildlife up there and the oil that's going to be produced. But it is in no way a solution to our problem. It is, at best, a temporary source which would be significant over a period of 10 to 15 years, and then it too would go its path. If you look at Prudhoe Bay, the same thing happened there. It was discovered in 66, and it started probably in 86, and declined in 96, and it's declining rapidly now. So these renewable resources follow a pattern of beginning to grow, hitting a peak, and decline. And it's woe to you who ignore these trends.
Do you have an idea how much of the oil from Prudhoe Bay actually came down to the lower 48 versus was used, for other debt repayments or was, shipped?
I don't have that exact number.
You have an estimate, or?
Well, my recollection was that the oil was mandated to be consumed within the country.
Oh, okay.
But I may not be right on that. It's been some time since I've reviewed that subject. But oil is kind of a universal quantity that can be changed and exchanged from between producers and refiners and distributors. And so it's really not quite so important. We're all in the same boat, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I think when the, you know, when people say, well, we need that oil for, you know, people down here in the lower 48, I had heard that at least some fraction of that oil was, Far East. But I don't really know. I was hoping you might have some information. Anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So one of the other things that that this bill that has now come through the House does or attempts to do is to promote construction of new oil refineries. No new refineries have been built here in the United States since 1976. Mm-hmm. And this is something the president has been talking about the last couple of days. And particularly, one of the ideas he mentioned was, well, maybe we could take abandoned military bases and there we could build some new refineries. And let me ask the basic question. When we look at this issue of both supply and price, is refinery capacity particularly a problem?
Well, I don't think it's not a long-term problem. It may be a short-term problem because of incidents. There was an explosion fire in Texas a couple of weeks ago, and that certainly didn't help the shortage. The refinery can be built in, you know, a couple of years, but it's not an instantaneous solution, and it's not the problem in the sense that it's just a one element in the chain of producing oil. And I think that it must be viewed in that fashion, that it is just a temporary problem, and whether we want to put them on Air Force bases or Army bases, is your opinion is as good as mine on that one. I think it's a little zany myself, but anyway.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Belgium, over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I really have a head scratcher here. We all understand that petroleum and petroleum-based energy sources cause global warming. We all know that it's all disappearing rapidly. And we all know we should conserve. We all know what to solve the problems are. But then just yesterday or today, Exxon made more profit, you know, several billions of dollars, 44% more than they made last year. And Wall Street says that's still not quite what they thought they should make. It seems to me really the problem is not our reluctance to move away from oil as an energy source, but our reluctance to move away from this cash cow that there is there.
Well, I hear you. The fact is that it's a major policy decision whether we're going to leave oil and go to something new. Our whole transportation system is built on oil, and it's totally hooked on it, and to imagine changing that is quite a task. I mean, we have only three sources: electric cars, which have the problem of not having enough batteries to take cars far enough. Then we have hydrogen cars, which are coming along, but they're still expensive, and there's no. You have to make the hydrogen out of coal or natural gas or electrolysis or something of that sort. So these sources, which would be available to reduce prices and provide a greenhouse gas safe future, it is not readily done. I think that we have to do is look at the three sources of nuclear, which could be a source of electricity, but has all the problems that people are aware of. And coal is probably the next best one. But in order to use coal to replace oil, you need to do sequestration. In other words, you have to bury the carbon dioxide underground to try and keep it from coming up and exacerbating the air pollution and the greenhouse problems. So all of these things are coming together, and whether the oil companies will be the suppliers of the future rather than, say, the utilities or some unknown but perhaps aggressive energy supplier, it's not clear at this point, but the nature of the problem that we face, I think, is getting clearer.
Well, it seems obvious that the people who are going to be the players in the future are the people who are making the money today to be able to afford these expensive changes, going to hydrogen economy or whatever type of economy we might think about going to when it comes to preparing our energy. It's going to be the winners in this battle who are going to be able to fund the next one. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Maybe I should just introduce our guest once again. We're talking with Dr. James McKenzie. He is with the World Resources Institute. He's a senior associate in their program in climate, energy, and pollution, as the author or co-author of many books and studies dealing with areas like transportation, climate change, energy security, global oil resources. He's professorial lecturer in the School of Advanced International Studies of the Johns Hopkins University. He has been staff scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and back between 1977 and 81, he was a senior staff member for energy at the President's Council on Environmental Quality. We're talking here this morning about energy policy. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. All you need to do is call us. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just a question, again, going back to the subject of how much oil goes into motor vehicles. We're now using something like 20 million barrels of oil a day, and about half of that, I think, almost half, ends up going into motor vehicles. And so we've talked about the possibility of alternatives to the internal combustion engine powered by gasoline. But in the short term, until we maybe get to something else, I think people now have been arguing and have been arguing unsuccessfully for some time that the government should require automakers to make more fuel-efficient cars. And if we did that, we could significantly cut our rate of energy use. How important do you think that would be, the so-called the CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy, yeah, if we could raise those and have more fuel-efficient cars, if everybody was driving a hybrid, how much would that mean for our energy use?
Good question. You are quite right that of our energy supply, about 40% comes from oil, and that is about 20%, about half of the oil. So it's a very large and substantial amount of oil, and it's also the major problem of security, national security, where we're having to fight wars in order to keep that gas oil flowing. I mean, during peaceful times, it's been costing the U.S. Financially about $50 billion per year. And the fastest way to deal with it is, as you indicated, is to use these cars that are now on the road that are extremely efficient. The Prius is the one we drive, and it's a marvelous car. And the reason that people haven't been keeping it, they haven't been using it as much, as there's a shortage of the cars, for one thing. You can't make them fast enough. And biggest problem is really one of supply at this point. Mm-hmm. And this brings us to the political problem, which is that the congressmen are loath to increase prices or to take measures that would actually encourage the development and use of these cars. People think that this is a big conspiracy, and there may be somewhat of a conspiracy, but in order to get these solutions onto the roads, we're going to have to pay higher prices. You see it now already. The SUVs are becoming politically unattractive, and the automakers are having trouble selling them now. So it's clear that prices will affect supply. It's unfortunate that we, as a country, cannot seem to do what makes sense from an economic point of view. I mean, Europeans pay $4 a gallon of gas, and their vehicles use only about half as much fuel as ours do. But we can't propose that. Bill Clinton proposed just that tax, an extra tax, and almost got run out of the office. So it's a difficult challenge to adopt the kinds of measures that make sense and that we all know make sense. But I'm not quite sure how we're going to get around this political issue.
A lot of people have talked very excitedly about hydrogen and the potential for creating a hydrogen economy that would take the place of the fossil fuel economy that we have, and using, for example, as you have discussed, hydrogen power cars. Now, there remain some significant technical challenges. And again, as you pointed out, we would have to have some way to produce the hydrogen the cars would use. And then there are questions about how do we go about creating a distribution infrastructure so that people would be able to get the hydrogen to put in their cars. You know, given the fact that there are a number of technical challenges here that we would have to be solved, what truly do you think is the potential for hydrogen-powered cars? And is that perhaps something that, yes, at some point we'll have, but who knows when, and it could take a long time?
You're absolutely right. The problem is one of making a hydrogen infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The two candidates, by the way, for sustainable transport are electric cars on the one hand and hydrogen on the other. And electricity has the advantage of there being an infrastructure in place. We all have wiring going into our house, and we can use that to charge our cars at night, or we could if we had the cars available. The hydrogen is a different problem. You have, first of all, where do you make it? And you can make it from coal, gasification, and you can make it from nuclear power, electrolysis, or you can make it from renewables, such as wind and photovoltaics. Any of those will do the job. That's expensive now, unfortunately, and that's going to slow things down a little bit. And then we have to get a better, cheaper, long-lasting fuel cell to drive the cars because you could actually do it with an internal combustion engine, but the push seems to be for the fuel cells. So that's going to take time as well. And then you have the whole pipeline distribution system. We have about 125,000 gas stations in this country, and so it gives you an idea of some fraction of those have to be converted to hydrogen in a short enough time to allow people to actually use them. So hydrogen may very well be an attractive source, and I favor it. I think it's one of the candidates that's going to be there in the longer term. But there are a lot of decisions that have to be made, to make this a reality. And it's not clear who's going to make them or whether everyone will agree with them.
All right. Well, we have some other people to talk with, and let's do that. We will go next to a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if anybody has done a calculation of the amount of oil that the war itself is consuming. It strikes me that to transport all the people and supplies and machinery and then to operate all this war machinery that is not fuel efficient must have a huge impact on the oil supply in the world. And I wonder if anybody had looked at this and calculated it. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure someone has. I haven't personally done that, but it is something that can be done if you can find the information for both the fuel and the infrastructure of building tanks and airplanes and so forth. I'm sure it's a sizable amount, but exactly how much, I confess I don't know, and I have not done the calculation.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello, sir. Mm-hmm. Fascinating topic, David. My question to you is, I know in environmental policy perspectives, technology is always viewed as the driving force that will pull us out of a situation if we ever get to the point of no return. And reading an article today about President Bush's pronouncements yesterday, he seemed to underscore that as his energy policy linchpin, that is, technology is the basis for the fix of our current problem. Is technology something we can look to in terms of environmental policy generally and now specifically energy policy to pull our chestnuts out of the fire?
Well, I think the answer has got to be yes, or else. And what I mean by that is that our energy system is not sustainable. It is finite in its amount. I mean, we have a lot of coal, but even that is finite. Oil and gas are both declining and have been for some time, and they're not sustainable. So you come to the conclusion that we really need to get new sources, and that means necessarily harnessing one of the sources that are available, whether it's renewables or nuclear, I don't know. But some form of technology is vital to pull our chestnuts out of the fire, as you indicate. And I personally am interested in the photovoltaics and wind, the renewables, and those are good sources for hydrogen, but they still have their problems of land use and water use. So they're, even the ones that are considered friendly by the environmentalists have their problems, and unfortunately we've got to learn to live with them or try and adapt to them by developing technologies which are friendlier than those otherwise available.
Let me follow up, if I might.
Sure.
I think President Bush is going to go on the air tonight to talk about energy in a sort of his Social Security proposal. Am I wrong in assuming that President Bush just decided to speak out on this issue because he now recognizes the political and/or economic impact this has? And I think you mentioned earlier, if these issues, environmental, energy, are so intensely political and very much economic, politicians and American people may not have the will to do anything but talk and not do the walk when we need to take affirmative action.
Well,
am I wrong in that?
I think you're right. The president's popularity has been declining rather dramatically, and he is, as any good politician who has the inclination to stay in power, has got to respond to those concerns on the part of the people. The biggest problem, in my view, is that the American public does not understand the role of economics in solving the problems and bringing forth new technologies and solutions. There are various ways you can make this sort of change happen. You can increase subsidies. You pay people to buy more efficient cars. You can tax them to represent the impacts that they have. You can use regulation in the form of CAFE standards. You can have other kinds of goals for efficiency and as the sort that we have for air conditioners. But all of those are just tools to be used to achieve the goal of more efficient technologies to help us deal with these problems.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just one quick question here. The Bush administration has been criticized all along for its energy policy, for putting the emphasis on increasing production of fossil fuels, also for the emphasis on trying to increase the proportion of the energy supply that's provided by nuclear generation, and some people have a problem with that, and doing that to the exclusion of talking about greater efficiency, that is, getting more out of the energy we use, and greater efficiency and conservation, and putting some emphasis on renewable sources. In the kind of conversation that's going on now, and in the kind of legislation now that's come through the House, do you see any evidence of any change in that, or are they still under-emphasizing, failing to emphasize, as far as you're concerned, renewables and conservation?
Yeah, I think that what they're proposing are on the margin, so to speak. They're not fundamental shifts in technology, and I think that Mr. Bush would just as soon rely on the market, which does not reflect the costs, unfortunately. So that the consumers are getting the wrong signals. they're getting the signals that there's plenty of oil around and that there's plenty of gas around because the prices haven't really risen that much if you look at it in constant dollars. So I think that he's not a profound thinker in terms of understanding what the problem is. And as a result, we're not getting a very effective policy. And I don't know who else is going to do it. I mean, the leadership begins at the top of the pyramid. And so far, we're not really getting the kind of leadership that we need to make the adjustments that we're going to have to make to deal with these problems. I just don't see it.
We have less than 15 minutes in this part of Focus. We have some other callers we'll get right to for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in here in the last 10 or 15 minutes. I'll introduce again the guest, Dr. James McKenzie. He works for the World Resources Institute. That is a think tank, essentially an environmental think tank. It's an independent nonprofit organization. It's been around since 1982, interested in promoting awareness of a discussion of environmental issues. He's a senior associate in the Institute's program in climate, energy, and pollution, and has authored or co-authored many books and studies dealing with issues like transportation, energy security, global oil resources. He's professorial lecturer in the School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. And we're talking here about energy policy. Questions are welcome. We'll get in as many as we can. Going next to someone who is in Chicago, and this is line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Before I get to my point, let me make this point. One of the callers asked how much of the Prudhoe Bay oil is getting down to the 48 states, and the basis on which the oil companies were allowed to dig or to pump out that oil was that all of it would be diverted to the west coast of the United States, that is California, Oregon, and Washington. Well, the fact is that that oil is going to Japan, has been going to Japan for the last few years, most of the time that the oil has been coming out of Alaska. And what oil that has been to replace that has been coming from Indonesia. Basically, what you're dealing with is a bunch of liars among the oil companies. Everybody is lying, and you're not getting anything. And with our government in the hands, controlled by the oil industry, among others, you're not getting any enforcement of law or anything else to the detriment of the rest of the country. Now, with respect to the use of carbon-based fuel, there's not going to be a replacement for that. I believe that the environmental conditions will trump everything that we have to offer as far as use of carbon-based fuel. And here we see the melting of the ice caps in the Arctic and Antarctic. The tops of mountains, the glaciers are melting. Everything is going into the sea, and the sea is rising, and the temperature of the oceans are going up, killing a lot of plant life and so on in the oceans. And in the not-too-distant future, a good part of the shores of the United States and the rest of the world are going to be flooded by the oceans. They're talking in 10 years or 20 years, so that, say, Manhattan Island will be under at least 2 feet of water, and an article I read a couple of weeks ago said 20 feet of water. Now, Louisiana is half underwater now because of the rising of the tides, and so on. I think your concentration, your argument in this program has been entirely a secondary matter. I think you should have been placing your emphasis on the environmental conditions rather than just using increasing the beneficial conditions for the use of coal, oil, gas, and so on.
The caller has raised a number of really good points, and we are getting kind of short on time, and I have some other callers, so I want to give the guest a chance to make some response. What do you think, Dr. McKenzie?
Well, I think he's right on the west diversion of oil from Alaska to Japan, but that was well known to be happening, and it was debated in public. And what happened was it would just save a lot of transport of oil and from other sources to Japan rather than to get it directly from Alaska. So I think he makes some good points, and I agree with him entirely on global warming. And it's you know, unfortunately, the effects, by the time they are noticed, have become overwhelming. And the points that you make are quite correct. The Greenland ice cap is melting. And all these dire things are happening, and it may already be too late, unfortunately. We're up substantially over the background levels of carbon dioxide. So I don't like to try and scare people, but I, deep in my heart, I think that we're beyond the point of no return in terms of climate change and its impacts on the infrastructure and cities and so forth. You're quite right.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is Champaign County and Line 3. Hello.
Hi, that's Grim. I wanted to return to the nuclear power thing. Price Anderson, you mentioned, and that's the government taking over liability for a catastrophic accident. Mm-hmm. Do you know the details of what this energy bill is relieving the nuclear industry of presently? That's a specific thing. And then France's point to a lot, which is kind of ironic, as a model for how much nuclear power they have in the mix. But it seems that even they are looking at sort of decentralization models. They're offering to the Olympic Committee for the Olympic Village is supposed to be a entirely self-sustaining architecture, in the sense that it's going to be covered with photovoltaics, and they're going to try and integrate it and be in a model of decentralization, which I haven't heard said. Since there's just a little bit of time, I mentioned that the Army is talking to GM about hybrid Hummers, but I don't really see that as a long-term solution. Thanks.
Hybrid Hummers, how about
Indeed.
That? Dr. McKenzie, again, would you like to comment on what the caller had to say?
Well, I think he's pretty much correct. The solar cells are expensive, let's face it, unless you're really in a remote application where they make sense. But at the moment, it's like 25 cents a kilowatt hour to make power. And so I think that prices are coming down, on the other hand, so that there is some hope that they will become more widely available. And I'm sorry, I forgot the other part of your question.
Maybe, again, it was going back to the issue of nuclear power, its viability, and what the government is proposing to do to try to help, to provide assistance to building, constructing new plants.
Right. Well, I think that the role of this subsidy is unappreciated by the American public. I mean, in the 50s, when the nuclear power was proposed as part of the Atoms for Peace program, the utilities wouldn't go near them. They wanted to build coal plants. They were doing just fine. And the Congress finally said that they would subsidize them to reduce the risks. And whereas at that time it looked like the worst-case accident could do $50 million damage, that's in 1955 dollars or something, that if you looked at the total amount of insurance, it was not enough to cover the accident. And so the Congress, I think, was put up $500 million worth of ancillary aid to help out in the case of a major accident. So by removing the costs and the risks, the utilities are granted something that they couldn't otherwise have. And in that sense, the cost is infinite for removing these risks. And I'm not sure in the detail what is being proposed, but according to the newspaper accounts, it is to remove the risk of unforeseen accidents. So I'm not quite sure in detail what it is. Is my answer.
I'll try real quick to get one more caller. That would be Champaign in Line 1. Hello?
Hi, Dr. McKenzie. I really enjoy this interview, and I just wanted to raise a couple points. Unfortunately, I know we're running out of time. Two things that I think are left out of this conversation that are a real disservice to the public are, one, renewables really have no chance, given their current level of technology, of meeting our energy needs. I've read numbers that say photovoltaics at best will meet something like 15% of world energy consumption. And I think the other issue that is left out is nuclear power in terms of using liquid metal fast breeder reactors, which were outlawed in the 1970s in the United States because of concerns of production of plutonium, but which are great reactors in terms of that they don't produce waste. They can let us consume waste that's available now, and that they're very secure physically in terms of you don't have issues of them going critical. You don't have issues of, you know, Chernobyl happening again. And I've never heard either of these issues really raised in any discussion in the media about these topics. I wanted to bring them up and see if you had any.
Well, in the case of breeders are not the benign source. They do produce all the fission products that a fission reactor would produce, a light water reactor, plus some more. Now they can't convert. They don't convert. Or they do convert a larger fraction of their uranium into plutonium and products, waste products. But it's certainly not true that they don't produce radioactive waste. They produce lots of it.
Pardon me for jumping in you that way, but we're just going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. Obviously, I think one of the things we're going to have to do on some future programs is talk some more about nuclear power and also about renewables. But for the moment, we'll have to say thanks to our guest, James McKenzie, Senior Associate, World Resources Institute. Dr. McKenzie, thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Bye now.
Our show, Focus 580, made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programs also made possible with support from Symphonie de Camera, presenting An Evening of Romance featuring pianist Ian Hobson. This is 7:30, Saturday, April 30th, in the Folinger Great Hall at the Kranert Center. The performance will include Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor and Serenade No. 1 by Brahms. For more information, call 333-6280. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today at 12:40, we are going to talk with writer Tayari Jones about her latest novel, The Untelling. And then at 1 o'clock this afternoon, in that hour of the program, we'll have an interview from the archives. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. May wheat trading at 3.15 and a half, down 4. July wheat 3.25, down 4 and a quarter. May corn 2.04 and a half, down 3 and 3 quarters. July corn 2.13 and